Yeah, you know, thanks for inviting me to give this talk. I gave a similar talk at MSRI recently, you know, for mathematicians, and I tried to remove as much mathematics from this as I possibly could. I still have to tell you a little bit about it. I want to tell you about simulations of fluvial landscapes and optimal transports. Most of the simulations have been done by my current student, David Chatham. Let me introduce my collaborators. Julia Rowlett, she's at the Hausdorff Center for Mathematics in Bonn. David Chatham is my grad student at Santa Barbara, so if you're interested in the simulations, you can talk more with David. And I would be remiss if I didn't tell you about the guy who introduced me to this problem, Terry Smith, who is retired now but used to be in the Department of Geography and also in computer science. And he is a geomorphologist, and it all started when he walked into my office and asked me to help him with some equations he had. So here's the outline of the talk. We're interested in erosion, and for a long time, you know, this problem was modeled. The first models, they were made by Terry and Bretherton, who was his advisor at Johns Hopkins in the 70s. It was Terry's thesis, and then they discovered that the initial value problem they were interested in were unstable, and they really weren't able to make much progress for the next 25 years. And then, you know, in the mid-90s, we had finally computers who could deal with a numerical methods that could deal with these kinds of problems, and that's what I'm going to be telling about. Now, it turns out there's a very interesting connection to optimal transport. That shouldn't surprise anybody, because after all, optimal transport is the problem of moving dirt to fill holes. There is a connection to erosion that turns out to be quite useful. I will have to tell you about, you know, it took us 15 years to come up with any kind of solutions of these equations, because they're very degenerate, very difficult to deal with. And I will tell you about the solutions that we have, which are entropy solutions and weak solutions. Then I will show you some explicit solutions that one can actually find that play a bigger role, it turns out. And then I'll try to tell you a little bit about the statistical theory, which we believe is the correct theory for this problem. So what should the mathematical model of erosion produce? Well, you start with some unchanneled surfaces, and you should see the emergence of a channelized drainage pattern from these surfaces. You should see the development of relatively stable surfaces characterized by branching patterns of ridges and valleys. This is what we see in nature. And then you should see the decline of these surfaces and the dissipation of the forms with time. And then you should see quite a bit of variability depending on, you know, how much the environmental conditions, how much vegetation you have, whether the land is mostly made out of loose sediment or rocks, and so on. Here's a typical simulation by David. So you can think about this as the mountains, you know, behind us in Santa Barbara. You know, these mountains erode over time. You get this pattern, typical pattern of ridges and river valleys. Some of the ridges, they turn out to be more stable than others. The ones which are more stable, we typically have this fork, you know, at the end, or the branching pattern at the end. And then we're assuming there's an ocean or a lake or a river at the end that can, you know, absorb all the sediment. And we're also going to be assuming that there is no sediment, you know, or water coming over the top. And these are the equations. So, you know, you have a choice here. There are three variables that you have to work with. But it turns out that the right variables to work with is the, well, C is simply the height of the mountain or the height of the surface. H is the water depth. The water is sitting on top of that surface. And then capital H is the height of the free water surface. And it turns out that the right variables to work with here are, you know, are little h and capital H. And the reason for this is that if you if you're on top of a hill in a heavy rainstorm and you watch where the sediment and the leaves and the water is going, it turns out that it doesn't go down the gradient of the land surface. What it typically does is that it goes down the gradient of the water surface. You know, where the water converges, that's where the water and all the sediment goes. And this direction is given by this unit vector, and it turns out that the evolution is best described in terms of the evolution of this height of the water surface and then the water depth. Now, yeah.
Ask for clarification. So this is all for situations involving relatively shallow water, right?
Yeah, I'll tell you about the assumptions here. You know, we're going to be doing the detachment limited case, mm-hmm. you know, where we assume that the surface is made out of loose sediment that can all be carried, you know, away if we have enough water. We're assuming that the grade is, small, you know, the slope is relatively small. The reason for that is practical, you know, it's difficult to solve numerically with steep grades, but we will see some steep grades. But the overall grade is supposed to be relatively small, and the water depth is going to be small.
So, I mean, yeah, it does not apply to the deep ocean where the water surface would not be.
Not at all. Even though, you know, some there are intriguing, you know, connections, but that's not the situation we're looking at.
So does this really make a difference in equation one? Because this is a bit different from what you normally get with shallow water. This distinction between the vector.
This is not
down the slope. I mean, they should be asymptotically.
It should
be the same to the same order.
Yeah, you shouldn't think of this as a shallow water equation. It's not. But let me explain. You know, what this equation is that this is really a model for the water flow. Now, R is the rainfall rate, so rain is falling on the surface. And what we're assuming is that there are many rain, you know, heavy rainfall events. The flow is turbulent, you know, there's enough water on the surface, so the flow is turbulent. And we're doing an average over these, you know, turbulent events. When you do that, out pops this model, you know, which was, originally just an empirical model over the water flow. And the amazing thing about this model is that it applies all over the world, very different conditions, to small stream up to big rivers. These exponents, they turn out to be universal. They are the same. And so don't think about this as a shallow water equation, but, you know, you have to think about it as some sort of an average of turbulent flow.
What is the physical meaning of eta?
I'll get to that in a second. Eta is it's basically the ratio of the time scales in the problem. So, and you get that from the ratio of the spatial scales. You know, the height of the land compared to the height of the water. You know, the extent of the water depth. That's going to play a role. Now, the other equation here has two terms. This is a transport term, and it's a similar model for the sediment flow. Now, this is not a universal model. You know, these exponents, they depend to some extent on the grain size. But it turns out that these values that I put in, they apply to a fairly wide range of grain sizes. But it's a similar model, except, you know, here the water is flowing, but this is the sediment flowing, and these exponents, they can change somewhat, depending on the situation you're trying to describe. This term here, which is the new term, or relatively new term in the equations, you know, it took us about 10 years to find it, actually describes the erosion that forms stable channel. Before that, we did a lot of simulations, we got a lot of braided rivers, but we didn't get stable channels. It's this term, it turns out, that gives you the stable channels. So, eta is a small quantity. What it's telling you is that there are really two scales in this problem, and they're quite different. There is the scale of the water flow, which is the fast scale, and then there is the scale of the sediment flow. You know, there is a much bigger scale where you have eroded a significant, you know, layer of the surface. And the way one can do the simulations, and one should do the simulations, is that you should do many iterations of the water flow, then you should do one step of the sediment flow, etc. And you should interlace them. And that's exactly how we do the simulations and how we get these surfaces. And I should say that this term was inspired by a paper by Kramer and Marder. They had a slightly different model, but it turned out that they had the right form of the erosion.
Can I understand? So if I subtract these two equations, I get an equation for the evolution of the bed height.
Right.
But why does that then still feature the rainfall rate?
Well,
that wouldn't cancel out between the two.
Well, okay. I made some approximation here. It turns out that you can write this originally as an equation, you know, for the evolution of C. And if that happened, you would actually get a term for both C and H. It turns out that derivative of H that would appear in this equation is completely insignificant and it can be ignored. And that's what I'm doing. But you're right, it should be.
When you say that the first equation is fairly universal, on what do you base that? Is that on observations that you have plugged
data
from observation into this equation and it was fulfilled, or?
No, this law, it goes back to studies of the hydraulic radius, worked by Chiesi. It has been, you know, known for a very long time, and it's tested, you know, for decades, maybe 50, 60 years, it's been tested in very different, you know, situations, you know, all over the world. So there are lots of papers, you know, that verify that these are the right exposure.
The slope angles in eta.
Pardon?
The slope angle comes into eta.
Yeah. The slope. The slope. Yeah, the slope is, you know, what these models are doing is that they're giving you a model of the water flow and the sediment flow in terms of the water depth and the slope. That's what it is. This is the slope. Yeah.
Can you motivate these expressions in your brackets there by simple picture or?
Well, you know, there have been some attempts to derive this, and I don't think they are that successful. So you should really think about them as empirical, you know, laws, even though I think eventually, you know, there will be a justification of them. But you should really think about them as empirical law for sediment flow and water flow. Yeah.
Equation, the h to the 3/2, is that portion there representative of something like the Manning equation or the Chasin equation?
Yeah, precisely. That's what
it started at 2/3 in the Manning equation rather than 3/2.
2/3. Well, I forget precisely the Manning equation, but what you do is that you combine the hydraulic radius with the depth. You know, I'd have to look at the derivation of that, but that's where it comes from. You know. It's an expression for the hydraulic radius. Yeah.
Is delta a material constant describing how easily material can get eroded?
Delta, yes. Yeah, precisely. That's this is a parameter, and it's basically the strength of the. Let's see. I think we are. Yes, that's basically the, you know, the. You can think of this as the strength of the erosion. Yeah. How deep the channels are going to be. Can I continue? So we have to start with some initial condition, and we're going to start with a, you know, with a linear slope. So we have a mountain in range, you know, let's say that the width of that mountain range is L. Sorry, the length of that mountain range is L, or the piece of a mountain range, like the St. Ines Mountains, and the width is W. And we're going to assume that initially we just have a linear slope with a little bit of water on top, that there is no water coming over the top, but then there is an absorbing, you know, body of water at the bottom. And the picture looks like this. So that's our initial data, that's what we start. Now this initial data turns out to be a solution of the equation. So if you just plug it in, you wouldn't get anything, but what we do then is that we seed the surface with very small noise. And as soon as we do that, it takes off and the evolution starts. Now, you can linearize the PDEs around the initial surface, and these are the dispersion relations that you get. You know, this is what you would get just by the first term in that second equation. And what you see is that if the water depth is small, you know, which it typically is, then all modes are unstable. All the spatial frequencies are unstable, and the highest frequencies, they grow the fastest. So this is a real disaster. In addition, if you add the erosion term, so you know what this means is that as soon as you put in these small perturbations, the initial surface is going to begin to channelize.
Can you tell us again what the variables are? Is omega is a growth rate or something?
Yeah, so you know, this is just the frequency, you know, for growth. So you just plot again an exponential function, you do a linear stability analysis, this is the, you know, the frequencies. You know, there are positive frequencies, and the bigger the frequencies in the x direction and in the y direction, you know, the bigger omega is.
But isn't that the definition of ill-posedness?
So exactly, it's ill-posed. So we'll have to talk about that. So if the erosion is included, then we get an additional instability. Now that's just going to be in a bend, you know, for a range of k's. But this is the instability that gives rise to the river channels. But this shows that the system is ill-posed. So that's a problem. That's a disaster from a numerical point of view. And what do we do? Well, you can, of course, argue that there is a natural curve. Namely, when you reach the grain size, you know, then you're not going to have any more growth. So that means that you should be allowed to put in at least some artificial viscosity, you know, corresponding to that scale. However, this is an ill-posed problem, and you have to deal with it. What will happen is that if you have a tiny little bit of noise, as you always have in nature, and as we seed initially, these frequencies are going to grow exponentially. But they're not going to grow exponentially. They would grow exponentially if this was a linear problem, but this is a nonlinear problem, so they're going to grow for a while, and then they're going to be saturated by the nonlinearity, and you're going to get in some characteristic states. But how do you capture this characteristic state, you know, numerically? And, you know, to give you the answer, it turns out that implicit methods, they work to do this, and explicit methods, they fail. They don't fail in the sense, in an obvious sense. You still get, you know, the large scales, you still get the valleys and the mountains, but what you don't get are the small scales. And I will try to convince you that it's really the small scales that are telling the story. So let me tell you a little bit about, you know, what we did. What we did was that we compared two numerical methods, one method which is fully explicit, and another method which is explicit but very controlled, an upwind method for the water flow. And then an implicit method, a Crank-Nicholson method, which is kind of the implicit method of choice for the sediment flow. Now, the explicit method is called the predictor-corrector method. What you do is that a step and a half, you do a predictor step, and then that's a backward difference, and then a corrected step, a forward difference, and then you repeat this in reverse order at step n plus one. And this works, at least to give you the overall picture. Now the upbeat method is explicit, the Kant-Nicholson flow is implicit, and for those of you who may not have worked with these methods, I just wanted to show you what the Kant-Nicholson method looks like. And the fact that it's implicit is that you're going to have n plus 1 on both sides of the equation. If this was an explicit method, you know, you would only get n plus 1, the n plus 1 step there, and the nth step on the right-hand side. So you have to solve this. It's a little harder to solve. You have to solve this by some scheme like the Kraut algorithm, but you can do that, and it's with modern computers, it's relatively fast. So if you want to use the predicted correlator method, you have to add artificial viscosity, and how to do this is something of an art. For the Crank-Nicholson and Upwind scheme, you do have a little bit of viscosity, but it's built in a much more controlled way. It's small, and it decreases with the discretization size in a controlled way. So if you compare those two methods, what you can do is that you can take the upslope direction. It's not good to take the downslope direction, because there you're going to be influenced by the initial surface, by the initial slope. But if you look at things perpendicular to the upslope direction, did I say this correctly? So, you know, the downslope direction is the y direction. If you take things perpendicular to the downslope direction, then you can compare the water depth, the land elevation, the water and the sediment flow, you know, if you average them. And it turns out that these averages are the same, you know, for both of these schemes. So when it comes to the large scales, both of those schemes are very similar. The number of ridges and the number of valleys are the same, and the half widths of the valleys are the same. So let me now show you some movies. See what this actually looks like. And I'm going to start with a movie where I haven't put in the erosion term. So you can play with this, you know, you can put in the erosion term or not put in the erosion term. You start with the slope, you seat it, and what you see is that you get this pattern. Some ridges are more stable than others. And if you would continue to do this.
Sorry, did you say there's no erosion term in here?
No, there is transport term. Remember, all of this, we're doing the detachment limited case. You know, no, sorry, we're doing the transport limited case. I'll talk a little bit about the detachment limited case at the end. You know, that can be added easily. So we're doing the transport limited case, all this loose sediment, so you can just transport it. You don't really need, it is being eroded, but it's being eroded just by the transport term. The erosion term is going to dig channels. Now, if you would continue with this, you would end up with a flat plateau. You know, so let me show you what that looks like. These are movies that were made by David. So if you continue to erode this, you see some of these ridges are going to recede quickly. You have some mountains at the top. But at the end, you're just going to get a flat plateau. And at the very end, the mountain ridges, they just collapse, you know, rather quickly into what we call collapsing hills. Now let me put in the erosion term. And I'm going to put the water on top of the mountain as well. So this is, we call this erosion term the abrasion term, because you're really digging up sediment now. You're not just transporting it away. And what you should notice is that there is some channelization. There are some channels which are forming. I mean, the time scale for the water flow is very fast. But you see some channels, you know, that sort of keep on meandering, you know, in these river valleys. When we return, when we remove the abrasion term, you're going to get, see braided rivers, but not as much of a channelization.
What is the time scale of the total movement?
Of this one? Well, so the total time scale is tens of thousands of years.
To what extent are the simulations grid dependent? I mean, generally with these most problems, you start seeing grid dependence as you find grids.
And you do with the predictor corrected, but not with the parameters. You can really take it all the way down to your discretization, and you don't see grid dependence.
That sort of suggests it's putting some sort of regularization in that you don't necessarily consider to be part of the model, but it's still putting something in.
It is there. You know, as I said, there is a dissipation, there is dissipation in the Krack-Nicholson numerical scheme, but it's very controlled. And, you know, and as you refine the discretization, that amount of dissipation is decreasing, decreased in a controlled way. And that seems to be the right
thing. It depends on the time step as well.
Well, yeah, there is a little bit of dissipation in the upwind scheme. The nice thing about the upwind scheme is that it captures features of the flow. If you have, you know, shocks coming down in flow and playing a role, which we do in this case, then that's captured by the upwind scheme. But there is also a small amount of dissipation built into the upwind scheme in a controlled flow.
Yep.
So,
well, coming back to this, there's it seems strange you've got a model that's ill-posed, but the numerical scheme
yes.
seems to make it well-posed or give you nice results.
It doesn't make it well-posed, but the point is that we can capture ill-posed problems with numerical schemes. We couldn't do that before, now we can. And I will continue, you know, we'll talk more about this.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, you can play all sorts of, well, let me show you one. Well, you can play all sorts of game with this. One thing you can do is that you can, let's see. let's go to this one. You can add a little bit of dissipation also, but you can make that dissipation dependent on the water. You only have dissipation if there's water, and on the top of the ridges, there's going to be very little water, and what you're going to see are some jagged ridges, you know, as a consequence of that. So here I added a little bit of dissipation, but the dissipation depends on water being present, and what you see is that now the ridges become a little choppier because there is a little dissipation, you know, on top, there is little water on top of these ridges.
This also suggests that there are strong supramonic instabilities here, right? Because when you look at the evolution, it seems like initially every second ridge starts to go away.
Yes, yes.
The wavelength becomes more
upper. Yeah, in fact, you know, where these ridges are located and so on is not deterministic. The only thing which seems to be deterministic is the half width of the valley, you know, and the number of ridges. That seems to be the only thing that is deterministic. Everything else is random, and I'm going to argue that, in fact, almost everything, you know, 99% of this problem, you know, is a random, and the theory you really need is a statistical theory. Now, if you put quite a bit more dissipation, if you put dissipation that acts everywhere, so it's, you know, so there's a lot of moisture in the soil, then you get things which are much, much smoother. You get land surfaces which are much, much smoother. And if you drive, you know, from here to the Bay Area, to the Central Valley, you go from Paso Robles to the Central Valley, you know, through hills that look precisely like what you can see. So we can build in, you know, additional features. In particular, what we can see, you see that these are much, much smoother. So you get much more smoothness when once you have dissipation everywhere. Now, we can also build in the detachment limited case. The detachment limited case is where you have rock and you have to wait for this rock to weather, you know, before you can transport it away. And that means an additional equation, you know, a dissipated equation. And first you run that equation, now you have three time scales. First you run that equation, and then you run the others. And I'm going to show you one quick movie of that, where we put a big rock in the, you know, in the front. And then we have to wait for this rock to weather before we can transport it away. And as you can see, that's going to have a big influence on the landscape. So you can see this big rock emerging now. It's beginning to emerge. The water has to flow around it because we cannot flow over it. So, and this is what you end up. Okay, enough moving then. You know, you're raising very good questions, and these are questions that we have to address. So, what can we really say, you know, about this surface? Well, there is a quantity called the variogram that geomorphologists have looked at for a long time. It's the root mean square of the elevation differences as a function of distance of separation, and you can do it, you know, with C, you know, the height, the elevation. You can do it with the water surface, and you can do it with the water depth. Now, this function is known as the variogram, height-height correlation function, the roughness function, or the width function, and it characterizes the roughness of the surface. And those of you who are familiar with turbulence, you recognize this as just the second structure function from turbulence. Now, it turns out that Krack-Nicholson produces two scalings, you know, for this function. For channelizing surfaces, you get a scaling of the water depth, which is about 1/2. Well, that is telling you, this is a classical model, Edward Wilkinson model. It tells you that you're simply going to get Brownian motion. But then, once you look at these more mature surfaces, where you have the pattern of valleys and ridges, you get a scaling of 3/4 for the water surface. Let me show you these plots, so that you believe me. So this is the scaling of the water depth. What you have to do is that you have to plot the scaling exponent, and you have to plot the scaling exponent as the distance from the base of the ridge, because the boundary condition at the bottom is going to destroy the scaling, and the boundary condition at the top is going to destroy the scaling as well. But what you hope for is that in between you have a scaling regime, a reasonably big scaling regime. And that's what you get with the Krack-Nicholson scheme. And if you look at later for the mature surfaces, and you do the same thing, but now for the water depth, then you also get, you know, you don't get the scaling, right scaling at the top and the top and the bottom, but in between there is a reasonably big regime where you see the scaling. In fact, it goes all the way up to 0.75 if you run it long enough. Okay. What does this then mean?
So this scaling tells you how the variogram depends on small h and large h?
Yeah, so it's the scaling with this lag variable. You know, it's actually a scaling. So you take two points, just like in turbulence. They're separated by the distance x, and then you ask, how does this function scale with this separation, with the lag? And those are the scalings of the lag.
It also corresponds to the power spectrum.
Exactly. you can also look at the scaling. You know, there's a corresponding scaling of the problem. Well, why are we interested in the scaling? Well, it turns out to have pretty big consequences. In fact, it explains a famous law from geomorphology called Hack's law. And this law says that if you have a river basin, and here I've shown you the biggest one of all of them, even though all of us do live in a river basin. This is the Amazon River Basin. All river basins, they have a main river. And if you look at the shape of river basins, they turn out to have a shape which is more oblong than square. So the distance, you know, along the main river is usually a little bigger than the distance perpendicular to the main river. And this is described by Hack's law, which says that the length of the main river, you sort of have to interpret this in a, you know, in a fractal sense, but the length of the main river scales with the area of the river basin to this exponent 0.58. And this turns out to be true all over the world, river basins, you know, small and large. Even though it can break down, and we'll discuss that as well. So, what can we say about why don't we believe the explicit methods? Well, the implicit method produces this scaling, the implicit than the open method, but the predictor produces the same scaling for all the variables, and that scaling depends on how much viscosity you put in. So obviously, that cannot be trusted, and you know, the fact that the Crank-Nicholson upwind actually produces two different scalings for two different regimes leads you to believe that that scaling is not simply a consequence of the numerical method. Now, I'll just for fun, show you how you can get from the scaling I showed you, 3/4, to Hack's law. Namely, if you want to compute the area of the river basin, what you would do is that you would multiply the length of the main river times the length of the basin, or the size of the basin perpendicular to the length of, to the main river. And that's given by L to the chi, where chi is the roughness coefficient, called the roughness coefficient. And that's exactly the coefficient we computed, that's 3/4. So you use that to compute the avalanche dimension, called the avalanche dimension. Then you invert that avalanche dimension. What you get here is 7/4. So you have 4/7, and that's 0.5. What it's telling you is that the scaling, which holds for very small scales, actually tells you something about the largest scales in the river basins as well. In some sense, there is no scale. All scales from the smallest to the biggest are connected. Now let me tell you something about optimal transport. Mons was one of the generals of Napoleon. And in 1781, he was also a geometer. He asked the question, what's the least expensive way to transport mounds of dirt in order to fill holes? So if you have a collection of mounds of dirt and you have several holes to fill, how should you move the dirt so as to fill the holes in the most efficient way, with the least amount of work? And as a geometer, Mons recognized that the direction of transport should be along straight lines that are orthogonal to a family of surfaces. In other words, a gradient of a function. Now, erosion is nature's process of moving dirt, and so it's not unreasonable to expect that there is some connection between erosion and optimal transport. And let's try to pursue that. Before I do that, I have to tell you a little bit about solutions. Now, as I said, it took us a very long time to find any kind of solution of this equation. What a reasonable thing to do, since you can think that what you're really doing is when you take the sediment step, is that you have let the water flow equilibrate, so you have an equilibrium water surface. then you can simply assume that you have an equilibrium water surface that satisfies certain conditions. You know, it's positive except on a septimation zero. You don't expect it to be positive along the top of the ridges. There is very little water there. But everywhere else, there should be a thin layer of water. And then you can try to find the solution of the sediment flow equation, you know, with that water depth. That turns out to be not so easy, but if you assume in addition that the water depth satisfies this very strange condition, then you can say something. This implies that the water depth to this power is in the Muenckenhaupt A4 class. Roughly speaking, what it's saying is that the water depth can vanish, but it cannot vanish too hard. It has to vanish with an exponent, and there is a limit on that exponent. And it was worked out by these Spanish and Chilean mathematicians that if you have this condition, then smooth functions are dense in this weighted Sobolev space. And the weight you can see here comes from the water depth. Water depth is playing the role of the weight. And then what I did with Julia Rowlett, you know, we adapted this theory and we proved the following theorem, that if you have a water depth that satisfies these assumptions, then with initial data in the right Sobolev space, you know, it's Sobolev space where you basically control one derivative in L1, there exists a unique entropy solution of the erosion equation. So what is an entropy solution? An entropy solution is something which is weaker than a weak solution. So what you do is that you take your function and you truncate it. If it's too big, like if these mountaintops are, you know, going up there, you chop them off, and then you take the soup of such equations, chopped off functions, and if they, so this is the truncation function where you have basically truncated these functions. You subtract the smooth function, and if it satisfies this inequality, then it is an entropy solution. And we showed that there exists a unique entropy solution. These are also very relevant for sand piles, you know, because these are the entropy solutions is actually what you would expect for dunes. You know, you have these very sharp embankments, and you would expect entropy solutions there. What we were then able to show, well, we don't know if weak solutions exist. We, for general initial data, we think so, or we hope so, but we haven't been able to prove it, at least not yet. But if you assume a little more, namely that the water depth is continuous except on the set where it vanishes, and the set where it vanishes, namely the top of the mountain ridges, consists of a finite union of piecewise smooth curves, then you can prove the following. You can look at this energy functional. You can show that both of the energy functional, the energy of the solution or the L2 norm and this energy functional are both decreasing functions. And then you can prove that weak solutions, if they exist, are unique. And you can also show that weak solutions are entropy solutions. Okay. Back to optimal transport. So what is the problem there? Well, you want to think about this amount of dirt that you have as a measure sitting over the plane, say, and you want to be able to transport this measure from one set to another set in such a way that the amount stays the same, that the integral over the measure stays the same. So the way you think about this is that you have a map which pushes the measure mu, you know, the mounts, into the holes. And we say that S of mu is equal to nu if S is a Borel measurable, you know, simply means open sets, measured with respect to the open sets, in such a way that when you pull back by S, this set E, and you integrate over two measures, they are the same. Now, what you have to associate this problem with also is a cost function. You know, how much energy or how much it costs you to move this dirt. And there are different kinds of cost function. Mons used the cost function with P is equal to 1. That turns out to be the most difficult one. You know, this has application in a lot of areas, and it's easier to use P equal to 2 or higher P. But we have to use, just like Mons, P is equal to 1. That turns out to be the right cost function for our purpose. And the general optimal transport problem is the question, does there exist such a map which minimizes this cost function so that the measure, the pullback of the measure mu is equal to the measure mu. And if such a map exists, then it's called an optimal mass reallocation plan or an optimal mass transportation plan. And in the context of erosion, we're going to ask the question, is the sediment optimally transported according to this equation 8 that we wrote down? I was going rather quickly, but is the question clear?
Yes. The thing that bothers me is, yeah. I mean, you're proving all these theorems on a system of equations that's fundamentally opposed, and it seems as though your numerical method may not be representing, you know, the underlying equation properly. I don't know. There's something sort of.
We'll discuss it more. let's discuss it as a statistical theory. We'll discuss it. Mm-hmm. But I have showed you we have solutions of this equation. It may be imposed, but we have these unique entropy solutions. So at least we can say something. And the equation is constructed in such a way that the sediment flow is in the gradient of the water surface. And what this question will come down to is that direction the same as the optimal transport direction? That's what it will come down to. Now, there are some problems because Mons problems does not depend on time, erosion does. Moreover, the mass of the sediment is not preserved over time since it's flowing out of the region. We're not really preserving the amount of sediment. But what we are preserving instead is, I think I jumped ahead of myself here. What we are preserving is the sediment flow. Namely, if we define this measure in terms of the decrease of the water surface, and the other measure in terms of the sediment which is flowing through the lower boundary, then both of the quantities are going to be negative because this is in the negative y direction as we set the problem up. So if we make the assumption that the surface is everywhere decreasing, which is a reasonable assumption, then it turns out that both of these measures are non-negative. And we can prove the following theorem, that if you have a function if you have a function for the water depth satisfying the assumptions we made, and a weak solution, which lies in this weighted Sobolev space, then the conditions for the optimal measures are, and we assume that these that the conditions that the integrals of the two measures are the same are satisfied, then there exists an optimal mass reallocation plan, so that there exists a function u, and u satisfies the equation. If you take the optimal mass reallocation plan, you make a unit vector, and it's just a gradient. Or negative gradient. And that solves the optimal transport problem. But is erosion optimal transport? Well, there is an additional condition. Namely, this gradient has to be equal to the unit vector in the unit vector down the gradient of the water surface. And that requires the curl of this to be equal to zero, otherwise we can't write it as a gradient. So does this ever happen? Or for what kind of surfaces would this be satisfied? And that brings in these explicit solutions that we have of the equation. It turns out you can find the explicit solutions. They're called mountains and ridges. They are separable, so you know they're just decaying in time. You can write them down explicitly, and if you plug these solutions into the equations, T and X separates, and you can work out what these coefficients are. And as you can see, the mountains, they look a little bit like the mountains that we saw at the upper end of the ridge. And well, these ridges, they are straight, but you can think about the ridges being pieced together, of the realistic ridges being pieced together of segments like that. And these actually satisfy the condition. So the conclusion is that once you get close to this surface, the surface of ridges and valleys, you are actually getting optimal transport. And the reason why we call this the landscape and that it, you know, persists for a very long time, much longer than the other stages of a landscape, is because the sediment transport is being minimized. The minimum of sediment is being transported.
And these solutions always have a concave shape towards them.
Yes. Yeah, that's the interesting thing, that these ridges are always concave. Now the funny thing is that as a mathematician I would call it convex.
Oh, okay.
But geomorphologists call it concave.
Well, in landscapes and my convexity and your concavity also exists. So what would be different about those cases?
Well, I'll show you. The Yongyang landscape, they typically have what I call a concave shape, whereas the mature one have this convex. Your
Yeah.
This is very confusing when I give a talk.
Geomorphologists in California also think that the convex crests that you see in California are also mature or long-lived landforms.
I think they are wrong about that, and I'll talk about that in a second.
No,
you know, at the very end, you get these collapsing hills, and you can also write down these solutions. They are analogous to solutions called the Barren block solution for the porous medium equation. These are the collapsing hills that you see at the very end before everything turns flat, everything turns into a plateau. And the interesting thing about them is that they do violate this condition for optimal transport. So the transport is not optimal on these collapsing hills. They disappear rather quickly. And they also violate the scale. The scaling breaks down. And it's interesting, if you drive up the Central Valley, you have the Sierras on one hand, where the scaling, you have all these river basins, the scaling holds beautifully. And then on the other side of the valley are these old mountain ranges, these hills, remains of an old mountain range. And people have done studies of those, and it shows that they've shown there is no scaling. There is scaling on one side, and no scaling on the other.
One question.
Yes.
What was your cost function, which probably is quite essential for getting these solutions? What does it really represent physically?
Yeah. So the cost function is basically telling you. I mean, so the exponent of the cost function that I had was 1. And basically what it's telling you is that the most economical way of transport is along straight lines. That's what it's telling you. And you know, and that was the same thing for Mars. That you know, if you transport, I mean these do not have to be straight lines all the way from the origin to the destination, but they have to be piecewise linear. And that's the most optimal, you know.
A piecewise linear with a kink is better than something gently curved?
Yeah, so apparently, you know, that's better. You know, if you put any kind of curvature on it, then you're going to pay more.
Can you derive that from the physics of the problem?
Well, I mean, it's consistent with the observation that the sediment flow is always down this line, this gradient of the of the water surface. And you know, I think that I shouldn't say more about that than that. That it's consistent with the fact, the observation that, you know, when the sediment flows, it flows in this particular direction. Yeah, what I was going to say is that in a way that's allowed us originally to get much further with this problem than we could expect, because it means that everything becomes one-dimensional in a way. Everything becomes, you can basically keep track of all the quantities by simply solving an ODE in these terms. I don't want to talk more about that, but I'll maybe mention, point that out at the end. Let me get to the statistical view. You would think that the half width of the valleys, the number of the valleys, are deterministic. That's at least a feature of the problem that is deterministic. But it turns out that you can also work out, if you take the, you know, the original height of the boundary, of the height of the biggest mountain at the upper end, then you can work out what the half-width of the valleys is in terms of Huxley, in terms of the scale. You can also turn out, if you use the length of the segment that you're taking in the mountain ridge, you can also work out the number of the valleys or the ridges. You can't work out where they're going to be located, that's random, but you can work out their number. So, not even this seems to be deterministic, it seems to come from the scale. And here I'll come back to your question. This is, to begin with, you really have three stages in this evolution. To begin with, you just have a channelizing surface. It's a straight surface, but channels are beginning to form. That's called the very young surface. Then you get into the adolescent phase, and there where you, what you typically have are these, you know, concave hills. You know, I mean, this, like, concave. And this is typically what you see in California. These are California hills. And you can work out that these hills are unstable, because it turns out that what happens is that the water flows down the hill. When the water flows down the hill, you know, there are shocks, bores, and hydraulic jumps. Water is accumulating at the bottom. There's a little, you know, convexity that develops. It propagates upstream, and once it gets all the way to the top, this is what you get. Farmers in California spend a lot of money, you know, driving dirt up to the top of the hill. And that's because those hills are unstable.
I also sort of think it sort of goes against my sort of physical intuition of mountains. They're sort of young mountains and things like this, like now, they sort of have these very jagged profiles, whereas the ancient mountains of Scotland were very rounded and they've had plenty of time to get into some sort of study.
Yeah, I'm talking, when I say mature, I'm talking about things like the Alps. I'm talking about things like the Sierras and the Alps. And I mean, you have had some tectonic uplift, but you have had a lot of erosion, and this is what the typical profile that you get. You know, so this is for the mature surface. This was worked out by a student of mine, by the way, Ted Wells, who wrote a very nice paper, and he was able to solve this basically an ODE using these ideas I was mentioning before. Basically an ODE for the water flow down the surface.
Any mountain that's radially symmetric, that would satisfy the del, that would satisfy the curl of zero, so that would be optimum except perhaps at the top point. Because then del H over mod del H, that will always be the radial unit vector.
Yes, but the water flow, the water surface, the free surface would, on that mountain, would have to satisfy that condition. And it doesn't in general, unless you begin to get these shapes. In fact, you saw it when I showed you this. You know, we started with a nice dome that was hidden there, and it ended up as one of these, you know, convex mountains. Now, So this is what these mature mountains look like. And what you can do now, and we did this some years ago, you can just linearize about those two shapes. And you can add noise, and you can ask what kind of theory do I get. And it turns out you get a stochastic theory of erosion. So if you take sort of take a generalized Hack's law, which you know applies for the whole lifetime of the land surface, then you get three ranges. You get the scaling exponent 1/2. That's just the channelization. That's the Brownian motion part. Then you get the scaling exponent 2/3. This is the student Ted Wells who worked this out, and it's the typical scaling of small shocks in Burgess equation. You know, it's a scaling of shocks, force, and hydraulic jumps in fluids. And then you get this scaling exponent, which also is typical for river turbulence, 3/4 for the mature surfaces, and that's Hack's law. And you can just work all of this out by linearizing the equations about these surfaces, typical surfaces. So that's nice, because the linearized PDEs, then they allow you to compute the invariant measure. The measure determines all the deterministic statistical quantities, variogram structure functions, PDFs, and so on. And these quantities, they seem to be the only deterministic quantities that exist, you know, for this theory. Now, what kind of noise do we pick? Well, we just take generic noise. It's wide in time, and it's as close, it can't be quite wide in space, because that wouldn't give us, you know, continuous functions or reasonable functions, but it's as close as we can pick it to be wide in space and still have finite energy. Which brings, so that's the answer to your question. Ill-posed problems, well, they're ill-posed. You're going to get many different kinds of evolution, but you have to average over them, and then you will get a statistical theory. In fact, the way we compare, or we compute all these quantities from the simulations, is that we do an ensemble average. And that's how we get these smooth relations. Yeah?
I have a question. Apparently, the things you are working with are things that are supposed to happen over a very long time scale. One of the things that we know is that when we remove mountain, then because of isostatic movement, they tend to mass tend to move back up.
Yes.
And that's proportional with the kind of with the sort of mass we move. Does that somehow?
Well, yeah. So you're talking about uplift, and I haven't shown you any uplift. But you can easily add uplift to this, and we've done that. And you can get, if you have enough uplift, you get the Grand Canyon. We haven't simulated that yet, but we're hoping to. If you have just the right uplift, you know, so you uplift at the same rate as the sediment flows out, you get a statistically stationary state. A very interesting, you know, pattern or river valleys and mountains. And sometimes you get big events, you know, in those statistics. So I have simulations of that, but I didn't want to go into it, you know, this talk. Yeah. But the question remains, is it possible that all of this just came from the water field? Because the scaling regimes is something similar as you see in one-dimensional flows in rivers. It turns out that you see those same scaling regimes. And first I thought that's where it was all coming from. But then we realized that the timescales are so different that can't be true. In fact, I won't, you know, tell you about this. I'm not going to tell you about this theory, but there is a nice theory, and you know, you can compute the Fourier spectrum, and you get these same scaling ranges. If you're interested in this theory, I can give you the references. But I'm out of time. The observation is that these scaling regimes are analogous to the regimes in the turbulent flow river, so is it coming from there? The answer has to be no, because on the time scale that the sediment flow is taking place, the you have averaged over the water flow. It's not there anymore. You have this average surface. So what must be going on, and we hope to prove eventually, is that the sediment flow equation just happens to be in the same universality class as the water depth equation and the Navier-Stokes equation. I think that that's what we think is going on. Okay, the theory gives an invariant measure. We hope to get the invariant measure for all of these three regimes. That's what David is working on. That's possible now, but we haven't done it yet. There is an upper cutoff having to do with tectonic forces, uplift, and so on. The theory applies to mature surfaces. For young and channelized surfaces, it still exists, but the scaling laws are different. And for the biggest range, you know, for the mature surfaces, which we call the landscape, you get Hank's law. And let me end right there. One can then, you know, push the optimal transport theory further. But you can ask me about that. You are curious. Here are some references.
Thanks very much. I have to apologize. I should have given you a little bit of a heads up in that the talks here. Yeah. We have a lot more questions and discussions than the usual seminar talks. So our talks usually start at 10:30, and it's not infrequent that they go until noon or even 12:15. So I hope you didn't feel bad that you had so many interruptions.
No,
okay. I'm
usually.
So there may be a few more questions, Jim. Yes.
So I'm going right back to the beginning. You have these. They're not shallow water equations, but I guess they're derived from the same wave with a long wavelength expansion, and it's known that, you know, normally, to be asymptotic consistent, you can eliminate the water velocity and get an equation just in terms of age. You get Benny's equation and everything else, but people typically don't do that simply because it becomes ill-posed. So in all of the, you know, geophysical flows that I look at, people keep U and H as separate variables, and then that gets rid of this ill-posed problem. So that seems like a more natural approach to dealing with ill-posedness to me than, I mean, it seems like you've done a great job, but it seems extremely complicated and technical and difficult
to go about it this way. I think the ill-posedness is essential. You know, you look at this equation, you look at the equation that I showed you in the beginning, and, you know, they look like perfectly deterministic equations, but they're not. You know, what they are stochastic equations in disguise, and the key to that is the ill-posedness.
The reason they're ill-posed is because you've thrown away a lot of other terms in dividing them, and if you include those, you know, which are physical terms, then they wouldn't be ill-posed.
They're ill-posed because small perturbations grow exponentially to begin with. That's part of the physics.
No, it's not in the basic physics. The basic physics of the water flow is, well, it will be smoothed out by viscosity and everything else.
Well, okay, if I put the... That's right. I mean, I did mention here that obviously there is a cutoff which is the grain size and so on, and it is true that if I put in a little bit of viscosity, then I would get rid of this ill-posedness. In a way, that's kind of irrelevant for this problem.
I mean, there's a cutoff in that you can't have any gradients which are large compared to your flow depth in deriving these equations. All the horizontal gradients have to be small compared to the flow depth, otherwise, you know, it's not consistent anymore. So that's well before you get to grains or anything.
No, I disagree. These equations are describing an average over a very turbulent flow. I mean, the overland flow is a very turbulent flow. You know, small perturbations are being expanded over time and saturated. You know, there is nothing deterministic about it. It's true there is a tiny bit of viscosity, but for the purpose of most of the scales you're interested in, that's, you know, I can help you to pose the problem, you know, maybe the developer's problem, but for this theory, it's irrelevant. I think this is very important, you know, very important.
Well, yeah,
I want to try.
We can disagree on that.
I want to try. We can talk about it. I think there's an interesting problem in designing this equation, but it's not small depth. You know, it's not, the depth is not too large, but it's not small depth. It's not. It's very different from the kind of equations that we get for very thin layers. But let me drive home this point, you know, because you start with these tiny perturbations, you know, which always exist in nature, and immediately, and you can see that in the new methods, they are being. I didn't show you the time. It turns out there's a temporal scaling before you get into the statistical properties, and you can characterize that temporal scaling. So I have pictures, you know, to show. So there is a growth rate as well that you can pin down. And what you see is that these small perturbations are growing. They're growing at a characteristic rate, and then the nonlinearities kick in, and you move into the statistically stationary state. And you have to capture it. You know, this is what you have to capture with numerics if you're going to get the right evolution. So the way I look at these equations is that I look at them as stochastic equations in disguise. And what you have to do is that you have to work out the theory, the statistical theory, which is behind these equations.
I sort of look at these sorts of problems sort of fairly regularly, and I've invented my own little post model, so I'm quite happy sort of talking about it. My particular take on these things is you really want the original equations to be ill-posed, but you don't want the instability itself to be suppressed. So you could still have all these small-scale things growing, and then they could all saturate and do whatever they do in coarsening and things. But ultimately, you really want to get rid of the ill-posedness to prevent grid dependence of your numeric.
Yeah.
And it may be in your numerical scheme that somehow one of the schemes is working because it's suppressing part of the coupling in the model. So it doesn't have the full time dependence or the time dependent coupling that you might think you have in, or which the equations are telling you. And it's very easy. I've seen it in a number of problems where in models, granular models of sea ice, where they basically say they have a time dependent problem for one of the equations, but actually the way they've coupled it knocks out all the time dependence and it destroys some of the coupling and destroys some of the opposedness. So the equations they say they're solving are not quite the ones that they are actually solving. You can easily get waylaid into saying, well, they look good, so.
I agree with you. If I wrote down the theory of my numerical scheme, it would be well posed because there is more viscosity. But the argument that I'm making is that you have to control that in a very strict way.
Wouldn't you like the physics, though? I mean, ultimately, these things are regularized by the physics, and wouldn't you really like to have a model with the physics that's regularizing it rather than a numerical scheme that's regularizing it?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think the important physics are actually being captured in these laws, in the empirical laws. And what I really would like to have is a nice derivation of these empirical laws, which we speak of, but I think that may be possible. If I added a tiny bit of viscosity to all these equations, I would get something which is equivalent to the numerical scheme, and maybe then everybody would be happy. I hope to bring this, you know, out in my talk, but I may be up to that.
Is the evolution of the drainage network part of what? Is that buried into your scheme there somewhere, or is that independent of what you're doing?
No, it's not. Well, it is buried in the sense that you can look at the river valley and you can look at big river valleys that are whole, you know, river basins with surfaces and so on. And how that gets organized depends on the initial perturbations that we put in. You put this on initial perturbations, and that somehow organizes the drainage network. I think that's random as well. I mean, what's not random about it are these laws that you can put, you know, make. There is a Strahler order, and you can work all of this out, and that actually can, you can use that to or you can use Hatch law to prove something properly. So, yeah. So it's all connected together, but precisely where the, these rivers and river branches lie, that depends on these initiatives. But you know, there is an interesting theory to work to connect all that, look in the basin and work out the star water and the links and the computer flow and the links.
Do we have more questions?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, well, thanks again.